The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Just a reminder for context, we're dipping into the book of Exodus, which in 4 weeks, it's really impossible to do any justice to. So what I'm really offering these talks as is really just teasers, trailers, so that you might go and read and learn it and mark it yourself and see what's going on there in that wonderful book. And the theme, I think, which is fair to hold it together, is the book of Exodus is really the world's oldest freedom story. And it tells this incredible story of how God rescued a group of slaves. Begins with them as an extended family, but by the end you end up with a nation, the nation of Israel, which is established. And a nation which comes into being against all expectations, with the mightiest empire of the world set against them, and Pharaoh wanting to crush them, to see the youngest newborn males thrown into the Nile. God hears the cries, the lament of Israel, and acts, intervenes in history on the side of the slaves. Now, that is weird. In the ancient world, the gods are always on the side of the powerful, and the kings are like their representatives or their children. But here instead, we see a God who identifies with the weak and the powerless, and the ones who are despised within the land. It's a stunning kind of reversal of expectations that the all-powerful creator God might be concerned with the liberation, with the freedom of slaves. The great one hearing the prayers of the weak ones. And it's a book which tells a remarkable story, therefore, about human dignity. It says something that this is not just the law of the jungle. This is not just a world that depends on having all power and being Pharaoh-like, sitting on top of the rest of Egypt, but instead sees that even Pharaoh needs to be accountable to the one who brought him into being. There's a law above Pharaoh which he needs to comply with, and there's a dignity about being human that he needs to respect. Ideas which are fundamental to how we now see the world, but so much of the way we see the world is because it's come out of this kind of thinking. So one of the things I'm doing at the moment is looking at some of the kind of 17th century political philosophies around religious freedom, and it is just so striking how often they are engaging with the Hebrew Bible. Again and again and again, they're looking back to what takes place in Exodus is normative. You can't go a page with some of the 17th century writers without tripping over the way they're dealing with the texts which are before us today. So it's a rescue story at its heart and a story of freedom. If you've seen the cartoon version, we're skipping most of the action. So the sending of the plagues, the parting of the sea, the song on the shore on the other side, how God had rescued his people. It's just an incredible tale, and you need to go back to it. We could spend a whole week easily just looking at the events of the Passover and how God's people were to be saved at the very moment that the firstborn of Israel were to die. But as they're brought out of slavery, it's interesting that they're not brought straight into the promised land. God instead leads them into the wilderness, and from the sea which they pass through to a mountain, to the mountain of Sinai. And he speaks to them through Moses and then to all of them. But when he speaks to Moses, God tells him, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." See, the image there is of a defeated, drowned army that had been set against them, longing for their destruction, and now Pharaoh's at the bottom of the sea. You've seen what God does to, you know, his enemies. You've seen how I carried you on eagle's wings. The image here is of an eagle that'll throw its young out of the nest and then catch it on its wings and, you know, float down with it. Terrifying kind of vision of freedom, except for the security offered by the strong eagle who's able to look after its young in that way. The young one who can do nothing other than sit on the back of the mighty eagle. Don't know if eagles actually do that, but enough people believe that they do that the image actually works, you know. And that's the image, that how God wants his people to see themselves as that young chick, helpless and saved and brought to safety, like that. Or the next chapter, chapter 20, just before the Ten Commandments, you have God saying, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You know, the very first category you use to understand who God is that he's the one who rescues you from slavery. The very first way you understand your own identity is one who was a former slave. You know, I once met someone who had been traded in sex slavery in Africa, and told this harrowing tale of what that was like and how she came to be in Australia, and her whole life narrative was about, I used to be this slave and now I've been freed. And it was a tale of praise for the people who'd acted to save evil, terrible evil. Well, on a national scale, that's how Israel was to understand itself, that they were subject to persecution and evil and terrible things happening, the genocide of their children, and a rescuer had come and brought them out of that situation and into a new kind of future. And if it was Hollywood, that would be the end of the story. You know, the freedom has been found, and the credits would roll. Freedom would be called out. But the biblical tale is actually very different from a Hollywood kind of take on it. If you look at the next verses which come after the eagle's wings, you know, and you've now been freed, the very next verses are saying, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. So they've been freed from Egypt, but they've been freed for obedience to God. They've been freed to be God's treasured possession. So it's not just a kind of freedom out of that situation and now, well, you're on your own, or it's just make up your own laws, or you figure out what you want to be, there'll be no constraints on you. It's saying now you are to step into constraint. Now you are to sit under a law. Now you are to obey a ruler who is not like Pharaoh, who will oppress you and bring you to a terrible end, but instead to obey the laws of a God who loves you and who has already saved you. So it's not just freedom from, it's freedom for. It's a positive kind of view of what's going on there. And I think it's very un-Australian, you know, because I think our vision of freedom isn't like that. Usually our freedom, we're kind of happy to sign up to freedom from, you know, yeah, sure, I'll have freedom from constraint. And a very little vision of what it might mean to have freedom to be something else, or freedom for obedience to God. That sounds like I'm buying into some other kind of slavery. Surely if I am to be free, I need to be able to decide my truth. I need to decide what my identity is. I need to be able to make my own laws. That's where real freedom is to be found, if I'm free of constraint. I think the best argument against that is to say, well, hang on, let's just stop and think for a moment and see, what does this law look like? Okay, so if law sounds like a bad thing and we don't want to be under it, then let's think whether it's good or not. So let me read from you for part of the law which is given there to the people. And this is from Deuteronomy chapter 24. And it's a long passage, but just listen and you'll get the feel of how it is that the law was to serve the people there as they were to serve it. It says this, when you make a loan of any kind to your neighbour, do not go into their house to get what is offered to you as a pledge. Stay outside and let the neighbour to whom you are making the loan bring the pledge out to you. If the neighbour is poor, do not go to sleep with their pledge in your possession. Return their cloak by sunset so that your neighbour may sleep in it. Then they'll thank you, and it'll be regarded as a righteous act in the sight of the Lord your God. Don't take advantage of a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether that worker is a fellow Israelite or a foreigner residing in one of your towns. Pay them their wages each day before sunset, because they are poor and they're counting on you. They're counting on it. Otherwise, they may cry to the Lord against you, and you'll be guilty of sin. Parents are not to be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their parents. Each will die for their own sin. Don't deprive the foreigner or the fatherless of justice, or take the cloak of the widow as a pledge. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. This is why I commanded you to do this. When you're harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. And when you beat the olives from your trees, don't go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. And when you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, don't go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. This is why I command you to do this. Does that sound like that law still speaks today? I mean, 3,000-year-old law, agrarian kind of society, but I think we can hear echoes there of the kind of shape that our law has taken. We'll have Michael come up and tell us whether it fits with equity. But here are principles here which do find shape in the law we have for a good reason, because they speak about really freedom being found in a concern for the poor. They had known what it was like to have poverty and oppression and slavery in Egypt, and they weren't to use their freedom from Egypt to create slavery for others. Instead, they were to build a kind of counter-Egypt where there would be a concern for the poor. True freedom isn't just absence, it's that poor are given basic freedoms and the ability to live responsible lives, that they aren't to be deprived of cloaks at night in order that you might have security. There's a beautiful dignity that underlies everything which is here in its respect for the poor and its concern that they too enjoy a freedom. Think too of the way it described there, the stranger and the alien. See, that again had been the experience of Israel in Egypt. They had been the strangers. They had been the aliens. They had been the ones who had faced persecution and suffered because of it. And they, therefore, were not to use their freedom to persecute the stranger and the alien in their midst. This one is completely against the norms of the ancient world in its concern for those who weren't citizens, who didn't have civil rights, who people in the ancient world just wouldn't have seen any kind of duty to care for. Why should I care for you? You don't belong to our tribe. You're not one of us. And instead, you get strong words like this. Do not oppress a foreigner. You yourselves know how it feels to be foreigners because you were foreigners in Egypt. That was the mindset which they were to take. Or take another example from the law. The way that the Sabbath was to operate. So the Sabbath means that one day in seven you are to rest. And not just you, but anyone working for you as well was to rest. And in fact, even your work animals, you know, the oxen and cow, weren't to be put to work on the Sabbath. Everyone gets a rest. And so there's this very egalitarian kind of flattening of the society that says everybody needs to stop. Everybody needs to down tools, and there's to be a pattern of rest here which shapes who we are, that we're alike, equal in the image of God, having a rest because he rested. not just every seventh day, but every seventh year. And there was to be cancellation of debts, release of slaves, that was to take place. And every seven cycles of 7 years, there was to be a jubilee year with a return of land back into the families from which it came, and a remarkable kind of cancellation of debt that takes place in the jubilee. In fact, recently, well, not that recently, 2000, we had the global kind of movement that was taking place around the year of jubilee to try and cancel third world debt. It comes out of here, out of these kind of passages, where the logic is pretty simple, that you used to be servants and slaves, and now you belong to God, and therefore you see yourselves first and foremost as His, and people as belonging to Him, not as belonging to you. Freedom was not just from Egypt, but to be enjoyed in this freedom. They were to build a society of freedom and to tell their children how important it was for them to have been freed from Egypt and what it would mean for this to be lived out. I think it's a very significant thing that they don't kind of go straight to promised land. And in fact, we'll see next week when we come back that there's going to be this awful moment where these people who'd been freed from Egypt and all its ways instead decide that they want to go back to Egyptian ways of worship and build a golden calf and join an Egyptian-like orgy and ignore the very commandments of God that they've just pledged themselves to. What happens when a good and holy God with a righteous law comes up against people who decide freedom looks like, you know, a pagan orgy? If we can understand that message, then I think it'll be helpful for understanding Australia. But this week, it's more really trying to think, how does this freedom give us a fuller picture of what it means to be who we're meant to be? Not just freed from constraint, but freed to live a good life, to see a good society kind of built, and seeing law actually as one of the keys to that. I'm going to stop and give you a chance for comments, questions. A comment here. The 40 years in the desert trained and developed the Israelites. These people never made it to the promised land, not even Moses. Joshua and Caleb did, though. So, yes, and when you go to the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, we're told a couple of times that this generation kind of stands as a warning, that we're to see what incredible benefits they had, and yet how they will die in the wilderness. There are real lessons there to be learned. But that's another trailer, another teaser. Go and read. It's great. What advice would you give lawyers about how to apply the Sabbath Old Testament laws to our work life? I think I find the... there's a great challenge there, I think, to trust the goodness of God when He speaks about the need for rest. And I think there's a warning there that says you're not just to work and work and work, that even as God works and then stops to enjoy the creation, we too are to do that. And it's hard to do that. I think it's much easier to just keep working almost kind of 24/7 in order to control things. I mean, how could you not work through that weekend in order to be on top of something? And we all know actually it's better if you rest, but there are seasons where it's kind of hard to do that. I think the beautiful thing which is set up here is a pattern of life which is just very, very different from how we think about time. Orthodox Jewish friends I've got say to me how just tremendously freeing it is for them in their practice of Sabbath, that they know that life's going to be busy and crazy, but it means that the family gets together for a meal once a week, and they're all gathered there, and all the devices are off. And as soon as she said that to me, I thought, wow, that sounds pretty attractive. And you actually are deliberately kind of stopping, and there's a cycle of life like that. There's a lot more to be said about that. But I think part of the teaching from the Sabbath is to say that this actually teaches us a good way. Now, there's a lot more about the Sabbath, and we'd want to think through its connections through to the New Testament and to Jesus. And a lot of times Jesus is accused of breaking the Sabbath. And the way he changes the Sabbath, so it's actually about him and the rest that he can offer people, the way he's able to bring comfort. But then the way that should challenge us not just to be slaves to clocks, but instead to think how we live all our life in connection with him. Much bigger thing I just want to kind of point there without spelling all that out. Is liberation theology a good thing? Liberation theology comes up in, especially in South America, especially in the 1960s, connected in many ways actually to Marxism, in a revolutionary kind of overthrowing of the oppressive powers of the state, and identifying quite strongly with the Exodus narrative as it does that. Is it a good thing? I think one of the questions that you've got to ask with liberation theology is who is the sinner that gets saved by God in liberation theology? Because the sinner that seems to be identified is those that oppress the poor. That's got to be the sinner, right? And so if God is on the side of saving the sinners, does that mean he saves the capitalist bourgeois oppressors of the poor? Well, no. No revolutionary Marxist is going to say that, and no liberation theologist says it either. And so you end up with quite a strange picture where God actually isn't that interested in seeing sinners saved. And so at a very basic level, I think there's some problems with liberation theology. And interestingly, it hasn't survived, really, in South America. Instead, South America went massively Pentecostal and prosperity theology. So they were much more interested in chasing the dollar than the revolution. But that's a cultural story as well. Okay. Under the new covenant of Jesus, what future is contemplated for modern-day Israel in the biblical context? Well, that's too big a question. Again, it's a great question, but very big. But as you read through into the New Testament, you see one of the revolutionary things that Jesus does is that he fulfills all the kind of hopes that are there for Israel. And so God's people are now to be made up not just from the Jews, but also, incredibly, from Gentiles. And it takes most of the New Testament, every book, there's a kind of contest. Is that really possible? Could it be true that people could be followers of God without being circumcised, without following the law, without, you know, doing all these things which are required? How could that be? And yet the news is that rather than the whole world kind of coming to Israel to see what it means to be a light to the nations, you see Jesus appearing as the light to the nations, the one who fulfills all of Israel's hopes as a Jew, and the gospel comes first there and then out to all the nations of the world, and so others are included as well. What does that mean for Israel? Well, it means that there's a mix there of Jews and Gentiles, of Christians, and you're going to have to come and see me for more details on more of that. God has not given up his hope for Israel, though, I would say. Is it important that we should all be part of a tribe, a group, or a nation today? I just think it's inevitable. I don't think we get a choice. We can't decide to be something. We already are. What that means for politics and so on, I think we can argue about, but I think we do come from different tribes. Some of you support Manly, inexplicably. No, actually, that's a choice which you can make and should repent of. But there are other things that we can't choose. If you did speak with the PM, what would you recommend in the care of the Sri Lankan family? How to express our concerns for the alien in our midst? You know what? This week was slated long before that became a story. Just as last time I spoke, it was in the middle of the abortion debate, and it was about Pharaoh killing the little kids. Right? So I'm not saying, oh, how can we connect the Bible to current events? I'm just saying, look at current events and the law will speak to them. How it does is a harder question. And the Prime Minister is in a hard position. There are legitimate things there where they do need to think about securing other things. I'm not wanting to read this off in a very flat way and therefore say this is exactly what it will mean in terms of policy or the discretion that an immigration minister may exercise. But I think what it certainly does is it rules out certain ways of thinking. That is, we can't just say that people are data points towards a policy, or that we can just think in utilitarian ways about, well, I'll treat these people wickedly in order to achieve a good outcome. Like, we need to say people are in the image of God, people have dignity, people need to be treated as humans, and not just as numbers or not just as means to some end that we may have. I think that would be a distinctively Christian way of thinking about that, without being, I don't want to be too prescriptive on what that then means, but if you look at, say, what the Anglican Archbishop came out with quite publicly in media over the last week, I think it was picking up that kind of idea that we can't just appeal to process and to and in fact where there's been delay in process, that we do need to think, what does that mean for these people and their humanity, for what that is worth. Last question, curious about thoughts on slavery to sin versus freedom from sin. Could you elaborate on how this practically works? Yeah, again, a great question. So the enemy we have is not Pharaoh. As you go to the New Testament, you see a picture where people need to be freed from sin, need to be freed from the flesh, need to be freed from the devil. You know, there are enemies set against us that constrain us, that means that we're not able to live the good life that we're meant to. And this in some ways sets up next week's talk in terms of what happens with the golden calf, and that the good that we should be doing, we can't even do that. So what good is law? Won't law leave us feeling desperate? And so we need someone to come who will be able to rescue us even from this good law, which leaves us guilty and condemned. There is a rescuer who comes. And Jesus is the one who does that, who's able to free us not just from those kind of deeper slaveries, but for a life to please God, one that is now possible in a way that it wasn't before we were freed. Short answer to a very long question, which is really the heart of what the whole story of the Bible is about.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.